I want to discuss today something that both involves this week's parsha and last week's parsha a little bit. That is, if you remember, towards the end of last week's parsha, there's a listing of people that are exempt from going to war. And in fact, there's a special kohen, and the kohen is called a Mashuach Milchama. He is anointed, and his whole job is to give the Musar Shmuzin, so to speak, Musar Shmuzin before they go out to war, that Hashem will take care of them, they should not be afraid. But in addition, there are four categories of people who are sent home, well, actually, not exactly sent home, but who are exempt from combat duty, and they actually self-identify. It's interesting. I mean, probably there was a check, but as far as the Torah describes it, you just say you're covered and you leave. But there probably was a background check to be sure that people didn't lie. And the first category is the person who has built a new house and has not yet dedicated it. That's the term that it mentions. And the Gemara in Saita says that it doesn't mean you have to build a house. It would also include buying a house. It would include inheriting a house. But you have a new house, and by dedication, we don't mean a ceremony called Chanukah Sabayis. It just means you haven't had a chance to live in your house yet. Meaning you bought your house, you didn't do a closing yet, so you were exempt from war, although you'll see what that means exactly. The second category is a person who planted a vineyard and did not yet dedicate it. Now this refers, once again, not to a dedication ceremony, but to the simple fact that when a person plants a vineyard, for the first 3 years, he cannot eat the grapes at all. They are what is called orla. And then even the fourth year, he is supposed to take all the grapes to Yerushalayim or redeem them, and that is called Revai, the fourth year. Today, this still applies. We have Orla, and the fourth year you have to redeem. We can't take it to Yerushalayim and eat it because we're coming. So essentially, this means if he hasn't had his vineyard for 5 years, he's only had it for 4 years or less, right? He is exempt from going to war because he hasn't really enjoyed the fruit. Now, the Gemara explains that even though it says vineyard, since the logic of this law is based on orla and revai, that is not limited to a vineyard. That also applies to any fruit. So it would apply to an apple orchard, pears, peaches, anything that are fruits. Now, things that are not fruits don't have the din of orla. Vegetables don't have the din of orla, but fruits do. So this is not only the vineyard owner, this is also the any fruit orchard. And the Gemara goes into detail. We don't have to go into all the details. How many trees count? What if you only have one fig tree, right? So there's a certain number of trees that you have to have in order to qualify. The third exemption is a man who did erusin and did not yet do likuchen. Now, these are terms that, again, as students of Gemara, you know this, but it's a little confusing. Modern Hebrew throws us off here. You're learning Kedusha now, see, certainly you know this. In modern Hebrew, the term erusin is used for engagement. Like somebody says, we're making a vort tonight, so if you want to impress people with your Hebrew knowledge, your Hebrew language knowledge, we're making an erusin tonight. Now, if you're just a Talmud Chacham who learns all day, you don't know modern Hebrew, you say, oh, you mean you're going to give the ring and say a Rebbe Kedusha's thing? Because erusin in the Torah is very, very different. Erusin in the Torah referred to the idea that a man would actually be Makadesh a woman. It was Kedushin. It was not engagement. It was marriage by giving a ring, by Kesef or Shtar. But in the time of the Torah and even the time of Chazal, the woman would remain with her father, with her parents, for an entire year. And only a year later, they would make Nisuin, which is consummation of the marriage, and the Chassan would take the Kala into his home. Okay, in other words, this is a very unusual situation that we don't have, it was very common. We don't have this situation at all, in which the woman is a married woman. In fact, if a Nara HaMorasa has relations outside of marriage, the punishment is more chamor than a woman even after Nisuin. A Nara HaMorasa gets skila, gets stoned for Znus. A Nisua only gets chenek, strangulation. Now, both of them are pretty bad. You don't want to get either of them. But in the hierarchy of sin, sekila is a more chamor punishment that is reserved for Chilul Shabbos and the like. Now, therefore, the concept actually was that there was Erusin, and then a year later there was Nisuin. Now, Bisman Hazeh, from the time of the Rishonim, I'll give you a historical day-to-day moment, we actually combined. So people don't realize a Jewish marriage today are two separate ceremonies that used to be separated by 12 months. There is the Erusin ceremony, which is where the chasan gives a ring to the kala and says, Harei at mikudeshesli. And then there is the Nisuin ceremony, which is fulfilled by the chasan taking her into his home. And the way that works today is that the cheder hayichud is a symbolic home, and that's why the chasan is supposed to rent the cheder hayichud. Now, here's the thing that's interesting. People don't understand this. We look at a wedding, and we see the chasan giving the kala a ring, and then the ksuv is read, and then there are sheva brachos. So so it looks as if sheva brachos are the end of the ceremony. Actually not. Sheva brachos is the beginning of the nisuin ceremony. The erusin ceremony, in other words, if this would be separated by a year, what you would see as an erusin is the chasan gives the kala a ring in front of Adam and says, Harib Gideshli B'tabasu, Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael. And that's the end. That's all. A year later, when the chasan is going to take her into his home, they would recite Sheva Brachos, and the chasan would then bring her into his home in front of witnesses. So Sheva Brachos under the chuppah are not the conclusion of the erusin. It is actually the beginning of the nisuin, and that is why we read the ksuva in between, because there's no particular reason why you have to read the ksuva. The ksuva is signed. That's the marriage contract. Why does it have to be read at all? Because since originally erusin and nisuin were two different ceremonies separated by a year, so even though we combine them now to be mafsik between erusin and nisuin, we have a ritual that is called kriyas hakesuva. Now, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, the minhag is that that's actually when the witnesses sign the kesuva as well, and of course, under the chuppah, it's very awkward because there's no desk, so they use each other's shoulders or whatever it is. In America, by and large, they sign the ksuba before the chuppah. And again, a lot of Americans in Eretz Yisrael do the same thing. They just go with American minhagim and the like. Now, that is also why there are two cups of wine. You may wonder if you were at a Yashi's chasna last night, or are there any other chasnas, the Baruch Hashem, we have simchas that we've had and that we're having. You'll notice, and it's good to notice this, because a wedding has many, many, a lot of things are minhagim. In other words, a lot of stuff is extra, the walking down with the candles and whatever it is, but that's not a chiv, so to speak. I mean, they are minhagim. But if in terms of the bare bones ceremony itself, you will notice there are two different cups of wine. Before the ring ceremony, there's borei pri hagafen, and then a bracha on the kedushin. And then, after they read the ksuba, they fill up a second cup of wine, and they recite sheva brachos. Well, why do you have to have two cups of wine? You're going to do everything there, so why don't you just have one cup of wine over everything? The answer is that this is another reminder. Since originally erusin and nisuin were two different ceremonies that were separated by a whole year, so we have two separate cups of wine, because if you were separating it by a year, you'd have another cup of wine. You're not going to save that cup of wine for a whole year. So it's very, very interesting. So even though it's now one big ceremony, there are a number of indicators that originally they were two separate ceremonies. Now, halachically, in the gap between erusin and nisuin, there's some very major differences. Now, Baruch Hashem, since it's only a matter of minutes, it's not a big deal. But in that year, there was a very big difference. For example, the husband was not obligated to support his wife until nisuin, not erusin. If, God forbid, a woman died as an arusa, the husband does not inherit her property. The husband inherits her property only after nisuin. Annulling of vows. You know, the halacha is that if a woman makes a neder, the husband has the power to annul her vow. Well, if she's an arusa, he can only do it together with the father. If she's a nesua, the husband can do it alone. Right? So there are halachic differences. Again, today, it's only a matter of minutes, but I do want to say that if a chasan gets cold feet right after the ring ceremony, before the nisuin, you do need a full-fledged get. It is an absolute 100% marriage as soon as the ring is received. Now, you may ask, you know, you learned the Gemara, and in the Gemara, certainly in the Chumash, there's a difference in Arusa and Nisua, and throughout the Gemara there is such a difference, and the Gemara talks about the 12 months. So when did that change? Like, when did we combine Arusin and Nisuin, and why did we do it? So the answer is, it started in medieval France, and it's interesting that the person who is given credit for being Mishana the Minna is a person that you have heard of. That is none other than Rashi, Rashi himself. One of Rashi's psukim was that in our day and age, it was appropriate. Because again, the Torah, although the Torah recognizes two stages, the Torah never required that it be 12 months. The 12 months, and you could make it shorter, or you could make it longer. This was the average standard time. So there was no violation of the Torah by accelerating it. And Rashi felt that the need of the Kehillah was to accelerate it, primarily for moral reasons. It was too big of a Yetzer Hara, that because a man is not allowed to live with his Arusa until Nisuin. So it was very difficult to say that they're married to each other, but they could not be with each other for a whole year. And also for economic protection, the idea was that it was important that a man begin to support of his wife. People were poor, they could not support all of their children, and that is why marriage occurred young. If you remember, did you learn the Tosos in the second parak, in which Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's own grandson, alludes to a different change because of economic conditions, and that is even though the Gemara says that it was prohibited for a man to marry off his daughter when she's a katana because she doesn't really know her husband and she might hate him, but Rabbeinu Tam says that their minhag was to do it, because you might not know you'll be able to marry her off later because you might lose your fortune or the like. So you see that this is exactly the same time, a little earlier, Rashi's time. Rashi was Rabbeinu Tam's grandfather, that they made a similar takana to combine Arusin and Nisuin. Method, Kevin?
Yeah. Yeah. I was just wondering why we did the 12 months in the first place.
Yeah, the theory, again, the 12 months was never required by the Torah. It was never a requirement. But the theory behind the 12 months was to give her time to gather a dowry. In those days, the dowry was very, very significant in a marriage to give a couple an economic base, and people needed a year. They were very poor. They needed a year to get the economic resources to be able to do this. So do not confuse this with the modern Hebrew word erusin. The modern Hebrew word erusin literally means engagement. In the Torah, Erusin is stage one of marriage. She's an Eshes Ish Gemura, and indeed the Onesh for Zanus is even more Chamor than the Onesh for Nesua. Why is the Onesh more Chamor? Again, so the Gemara itself says, because when she's an Arusa, that's Mizana, she brings shame not only on her husband, but also her father, because she's an in-between status. When she's Mizana as a Nesua, she's already out of her father's rishus, so she's only humiliating her husband, not her father, and therefore the punishment is less, because part of the onus is not just the sin to Hashem, which of course it is, but it's also the humiliation and the shame that you bring to others. By the way, Abkidei Kach, again, I'm digressing very far afield here, but there's a very famous tshuva of the Knight of Yehuda, the great Rav of Prague of the 1700s, in which a person was mezana with his mother-in-law. He was mezana with his mother-in-law. He then became a Baal Tshuva, and he wanted to know, was he mechuyev to tell his father-in-law that he was mezana with his mother-in-law? Because if he tells his father-in-law, because remember, if a woman is mezana beratzen, she cannot stay married to her husband. So if he doesn't tell, he's going to cause the husband to be doing an aveira. Is he mechuyev to tell? So the Achrayim talk about this. The Neidav Yehuda says yes, actually, but other poskim say no. But that's the idea. But those who say no is because even though by not telling, the father-in-law is doing a tremendous sin every single day, but to spare embarrassments, you might be allowed to cover up a sin. There is a concept that for covered up rios, you're not necessarily mechuyev to tell somebody that they're doing an aveira. But this is a complicated shaila. Rav Avadya had a similar problem with the Pidgin Aben, where a woman got married and she had a history of being with other people, and she had had an abortion as a single woman, and now she's having a child, and the husband is so happy because this is the firstborn child, and he's going to make a pidyon haben. And the question is, however, she never told him, the question is, this is not her first child, and there would be no pidyon haben. And the Rav Avadya actually paskens, in order to avoid her humiliation, it would be permitted to even allow a brachal of atala to be recited with pidyon haben. This is the whole sugya of covered up priests. Okay. So be it as it may, this is some general background information, but that's what the Torah is talking about. So it really wouldn't apply today in any sense. If a person is in a state of erusin and he has not yet made nisuin, he is allowed to go home. He is sent away from the battlefield. So we have three categories so far. The first is the house that you haven't lived in. The second is the vineyard that you have not yet enjoyed the fruit because you're still within the first 4 years. The third is erusin, without nisuin. And the fourth is the strangest of all. That is, hey, if you're scared, go home. Well, you wonder who's going to stick around. Now, there's a machlokas in the Mishnah, and Rashi brings the two opinions. Who are the scared people who get to go home? According to one opinion, it means a person who is frightened because of his sins. He thinks that he is not worthy, and because of his averos, Hashem is going to punish him. According to another opinion, even if a person is just scared, and the theory is psychologically that when a person is overly frightened and just really gets cannot control himself, that can have a contagious, debilitating effect on combat morale. Everybody else gets frightened as well. Now, once he doesn't step forward, if in the middle of the military victory, he starts a military struggle, he gets scared, he can actually be killed on the spot because he's considered to be an endangerer, a rodent of everybody else. Okay. Now, it's important to know the following. These are four categories of exemptions, but they are not absolute. We will call these limited exemptions. And the reason why they're limited is they have two limitations. First, according to the Gemara and Saita, it does not mean they go home. They do not go home. It means they get reassigned from a combat role to a back of the lines role, meaning they still have to be in the army. This does not send them home. They have to be in the army, but instead of being in a combat where they're exposed to danger, they're either in the back office or they're in the kitchen or they're doing the medics or whatever it is. So that's one limitation. Now you're going to see that in Kiseite there's a whole other limitation which is very different. The second is that even this exemption only applies to what is called a milchemes rishus and not what is called a milchemes mitzvah. There are two types of wars that we have. We have what are called mitzvah wars, obligatory wars, and we have what are called optional wars. Now that's a very strange term. An obligatory war, as the Rambam defines it, involves one of three scenarios. It is either a war against the seven nations that inhabited Canaan, which are all extinct, they don't even exist today, or the war against Amalek, which also does not exist as a distinct nation. And the third category is a war to defend the Jewish people from those who try to destroy it. Unfortunately, that is the one category of milchemes mitzvah that still exists today. And the Mishnah in Sota says that these exemptions only apply to milchemes rishus, optional war. I'll talk about what an optional war is. It does not apply to milchemes mitzvah. So these four exemptions have two limitations. I'll take them in reverse order. Number one, they only apply to milchemes rishus, not milchemes mitzvah. And number two, even in milchemes rishus, it doesn't get you home. It only moves you from the front lines to the back lines, and you still have to be involved in the combat effort. Now, what is a milchemes rishus? That's a strange thing. Optional wars? Well, these are wars of expansion, which are not self-defense. Well, that sounds a little bizarre. I mean, Judaism allows us, let's say we just decide we would like to take over some territory. I don't mean territory within the boundaries of Israel. That might be a Mechanis mitzvah. But I mean, let's say, you know, we'd like to take over Saudi Arabia. And, you know, the oil is there and everything else. So we're allowed to have a Mechanis Rishus? Well, the truth is, yes, but the conditions of Mechanis Rishus are so strict that there's no way we could do that today at all. A Mechanis Rishus requires, number one, the authorization of a Sanhedrin, which we don't have, and we discussed last week because there's no smicha. And most importantly, Milchemes Rishus requires the authorization of a prophecy through the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim are the jewels that the Kohen Gadol wears, and in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, in the second Beis HaMikdash, even though the Kohen Gadol had the jewels, there was no prophecy there. In other words, Milchemes Rishus actually means it's got to be authorized by God. God gives you permission. So today, there's no way. So today, the only halachic category of a war that is justifiable, that is permitted, is a defensive war. And if it's permitted, it then becomes a Milchemes Mitzvah. Yeah.
What if the defensive war is planned into a war expansion? They attack you, you start winning.
Yes, those are very good questions. So it really depends. Once you're in a defensive posture, you are permitted to take territory that you deem is necessary for security concerns. So it wouldn't be for expansionist concerns, but it may include a certain amount of conquest for security concerns. Another parallel question, which is very similar, is what is the status of preemptive strikes? That's a very, very serious question. Occasionally, what Israel has to do is they don't wait until the bombs start, although lately that's what we do. But if you remember, in Lebanon, there are times that Israel has actually invaded Lebanon or the like in order to uproot terrorist activity that is there. And here, too, I mean, there are different opinions and different understandings. And, of course, either way, the government tends not to ask that many shilas in this area. But here, too, it is understood that the notion of defense may require aggressive offense, simply because you can't wait until the enemy attacks you, because then it might be too late. So preemption is nichlal in defense. So I want to point out, therefore, that the exemptions in Parsha Shoftim do not apply to Milchemes Mitzvah at all. And even in Milchemes Rishus, they don't mean you go home, which we don't have today anyway. They don't mean you go home. They just mean that you're assigned to a non-combat position.
Aren't there many people who hold that the halachic state of Israel hasn't been reestablished? And if so, how could it be considered a defensive war if you already have the same?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the answer to that is the following. The answer to that is, what makes it a legitimate defensive war is not defense of the state, but it is defense of the Jewish people who will be killed by this type of activity. So the Rambam deliberately shifts the emphasis not to the protection of an entity that is called the state, but rather the entity of an endangered population of Jews. So in theory, you can have a Milchemes Mitzvah even outside of the land of Israel when you have an endangered Jewish population. So it would appear, again, you have to see how this works out, that even if one is ideologically opposed to the state of Israel, one believes that we're not allowed to have a state of Israel until the coming of Mashiach, right? That's the position of the Turei Karta. Excuse me, that would not negate the Milchemes Mitzvah status of defending Jews from attack. Now, I didn't discuss, now notice a few things, two things. You'll notice in this list, we mentioned four exemptions. There are two exemptions that are not mentioned here. It does not mention women being exempt. Just does not mention, and it does not mention students of Torah, you know, being exempt. Okay, so leave that as an aside. Right now, I just want to focus on what the Chumash directly says. Obviously, for the people in this room, the most relevant exemption to consider, and one which is under great controversy now, is the exemption for people learning Torah. And we'll see that there is somewhat of an exemption, but it is not directly in this parsha. That's all. It's not in the Chumash. I'll get back to that later. What I want to contrast, however, is that in the middle of Kisetse, this week's parsha, There is another exemption, and it's important to know that this exemption is totally different than the exemptions in Parshas Shoftim. It says, when a man has taken a new wife, it says he shall not go to war, and he shall not be expected to be involved in any public national service. And he is given a one-year exemption. Naki yiya lebeso shana achas. Naki, he shall be totally free of all responsibilities for 1 year. V'simach es ishto asher lakach. So he can rejoice with the wife, with the woman that he has taken. This is the source of the well-known expression, shana rishona, the first year of marriage, has to be very, very special. You don't go out on trips without your wife, etc. Again, people discuss, some people even say that if you're in yeshiva kolel, now this doesn't mean you stay home for a whole year. First of all, it's not good for your learning, and it's not even good for your marriage. A wife would like to get rid of you a little bit. Don't hang around all the time. But many, many rabbanim will advise you, and again, I'm not paskening, ask your rebbe, but many rabbanim will advise you that for shana rishona you have a night seder chavrusa at home. And people say, well, what's the purpose of that? I mean, I'm not going to talk to my wife anyway for the 2 hours. But the truth of the matter is, the presence of a husband at home is something that's very comforting. Even if she's doing her thing, you're doing your thing. The fact that you're around, and if there's a need to have an interaction, it's there, you're there. That does make a big difference. Okay, but be it as it may, this we will call a super exemption. Now the difference, let's compare the marriage exemption in Shoftim and the marriage exemption in Kisese. The marriage exemption in Shoftim is when she's an Arusa and you haven't had Nisuin. So then, we'll send you to the back lines. And if it's Milchanis Mitzvah, you actually have to fight if necessary. The exemption in Kisese is super exemption. Once you have made Nisuin, Shana Rishaina exempts you Lagamri. Even, according to the Rambam, in Milchames Mitzvah, amazingly enough, and not only are you exempt from frontline service, you literally go home. Now, today, this would actually mean, it would appear, since today we never have a status of an Arusa when you get married. I mean, unless the army gets you, between Sheva Brachas on the Yichud Room, they kind of stuff you around. They're going to have to get you there. But today, for all practical intents and purposes, after your chasna, there is Nisuin. The day of your wedding is Nisuin already. So that would actually mean, now the Israeli army does not follow this. This would actually mean that a person who is married is exempt even from Nochanes Mitzvah for Shana Rishona. That is the halacha. So, if you're a yeshiva guy that's in danger of getting drafted, best bet is, well, it's not going to work, but the theoretical halachic bet is, get yourself married, and then you're given an automatic Shana Rishona deferment. But again, that's not going to work. The army's not going to buy that, so you'll be in trouble. Yeah?
Is that the same for training and regular?
Okay. Sorry, for what?
For regular, just regular service.
Yes, it does apply because the Torah emphasizes that you're free of everything. That would even include Shevet Lumi, that would include any mandatory leaving of your home. Now, if they give you a job, which is, let's say, 9 to 5 or whatever the Israeli hours are, that's different. But anything that requires you to be away from home overnight, you are puter from. Now, even though the Torah uses Shana Rishaina only in the case of marriage, the Gemara in Saita is marbe that this also applies to the other things as well. There's a Shana Rishaina of bias, strangely enough. Meaning, it's a strange thing. Until I live in my house, I have to go to Milchames Mitzvah and Milchames Rishus, I do backline duty. But once I lived in my house one night, I get a Shana Rishona exemption. It's a little strange. Why is the Torah giving me a bigger break if I lived in my house less than a year than if I didn't live there at all? But again, the idea is that the pain of separation is greater once you've enjoyed. Same thing with the vineyard. until you're able to eat of the fruit, you have the Parshas Shoftim exemption. Once you eat of the fruit, you have a Shana Rishona exemption. Okay, so we can call them, again, I just want to point out, halachically, that the Parshas Shoftim exemptions are the limited exemptions, and the Parshas Kiseitse Shana Rishona exemption are the super exemptions. Okay, and the Shana Rishona exemption applies to Nisuin, which is the most obvious, that's what the Torah says in Feirish. It also applies to Kerem, vineyard or orchard, and it also applies to bias, even a house. So buying a house is another halachic way you could, if you live in the house right away, you get yourself a year that way. Now, as I indicated, the two, in either of these, we have two lists here. But in either of these lists, there are two omissions that one would wonder about. And that is, what is the status of women in war, or the army, and what is the status of people who are learning Torah? Now let's take the learning Torah first. The truth of the matter is that if you ask, does the Torah say explicitly that those who learn Torah full-time are exempt from military service, a strong case could be made that they're not exempt, and indeed, you can always bring up what Moshe Rabbeinu told the 2.5 tribes when they wanted to stay behind and settle the east of the Yarden, and Moshe Rabbeinu gave the very impassioned speech, your brethren are going to war, and you want to be here. And that's the philosophy of Hester. But the halachic basis for exempting students of Torah from even Mochemes Mitzvah, and again, I'm not going to be political here, I'm going to just deal with the halachic text, is a combination of two halachas in the Rambam. Now, it's very interesting. You need to take two different pieces of the Rambam, which are not connected by the Rambam himself, and connect them. The first is a statement of the Rambam that Shevet Levi was exempt from all military service, even Milchemes Mitzvah. Shevet Levi was exempt. What's the mukkar of that? That's not in the Gemara. And the Mefarshim of the Rambam want to know, where does the Rambam get the idea that Shevet Levi was exempt from Milchama? But they say that the Rambam's makor is a Sifri that says that when the Torah says Shevet Levi does not inherit land in the land of Israel, that also connotes they don't have to fight for that land and they're exempt from Milchama. Okay, that's Rambam number one. There is then another Rambam, which is not talking about war at all, where the Rambam at the end of Shemitah and Yovel discusses the idea that Shevet Levi represents the tribe of Israel that was consecrated to the service of God, and that's why they weren't supposed to own land, so they could focus all of their, they shouldn't be distracted by ownership of things. All of their kochos should be focused on learning and on teaching and on Avodas Hashem. And then the Rambam goes on and says, and this idea of dedicating your life to serving Hashem is not limited to Shevet Levi, but any person whose heart pulls him to devote himself to God and to forsake the Havlei Olam Hazeh, the futilities of this world, Hashem will give him the zechus of Shevet Levi. Now, I want to point out, it's important that you know this, the Rambam there is not referring to not having to go to the army. The Rambam is referring to the spiritual role of Shevet Levi. But the halachic argument that's been made is you take 1 + 1 and you make 2, meaning if Shevet Levi is exempt, and that's the Rambam says, and if the Rambam says spiritually, the person who devotes himself to Avodas Hashem is spiritually a Levite, so then he could plug himself into that other statement that Shevet Levi is putter from even Milchemes Mitzvah. Now again, there are questions on each side of this equation. There are many who argue with the Rambam's yisoid that Shevet Levi is putter. And number two, even if you accept that Shevet Levi is putter, the Rambam didn't mean to extend that to the Talmud Chacham, But overall, it is true, and that's the halachic basis. Now, the philosophical basis is also something that is, of course, understood, and that is, we do understand that the military victories of Am Yisrael depend, number one, on having an army. We do have to have an army, but overwhelmingly on HaKadosh Baruch Hu giving us a bracha. Without HaKadosh Baruch Hu's bracha, there's no way anyone could ever succeed, and certainly B'derech HaTeva, there's no way Israel could succeed, surrounded by millions and millions and millions of hostile enemies that want to destroy us. We could be crushed every second, any minute, by everybody. And therefore, it is only the special love and divine assistance that Hashem gives us that will enable the army to be successful. And we know that Limud HaTorah and Mitzvos are the most powerful vehicles that bring that bracha. So I've said this before, to me it's so obvious I shouldn't even say it, but I will say it because some things are not so obvious in our society. One needs to have a great deal of appreciation for the army. The soldiers in the army deserve respect. They deserve admiration. These are people who are risking their lives. There are people who get killed doing this work. And whether they're Chiloni, whether they're Hester, which is even a bigger Kiddush Hashem, whatever they are, one has to be very, very grateful. And one has to be very appreciative. But at the same time, one knows, every Maimon knows, that Limud HaTorah brings tremendous bracha on Am Yisrael. So anything like, you know, when a religious soldier, when a religious soldier goes into a Beis Medrash to Daven Ma'ariv, and he gets assaulted, gets beaten up, and gets kicked out, and that's why the army has issued a directive that soldiers are allowed to go to synagogues in civilian clothes in order to avoid being attacked. That is, what can I describe it as? It's a Chilul Hashem. It is what the Ramban calls a novel Bershus HaTorah, a disgusting person. Anyone that does that is an absolutely disgusting person, even if they keep all of the other mitzvahs of the Torah. So the point basically is that one can respect the army, one can appreciate what they're doing, one can really be very, very grateful for them. At the same time, understand that Klal Yisrael needs the blessings that come from Limud HaTorah. Seen in this way, the Talmud of the Yeshiva and the soldier are not antagonists. They're not like enemies. We're all on the same team. We want Eretz Yisrael to be safe. We want Jews to be safe. We want enemies and not to hurt people. We want to bring Geula. And some people do it through their Torah learning. Some people do it through their military establishment. Some people combine both in different ways. And there has to be a Hakara Satov on both sides. And I have said many, many times that in some ways, if we would appreciate the contribution of the other groupings, perhaps they would also appreciate what B'nai Torah do as well. So you have to be aware of that. So be it as it may, I just wanted to tell you that halachically, the exemption of people who are learning Torah from Milchama is based on a combination of two statements in the Rambam that are nailed together. Yeah.
From the halachic perspective, do we say that the wars that Israel goes to are called Milchama Mitzrayim? If it is, do we say that at that point everyone in Israel is mechuyav to come to such a war?
Well, here's the thing. Even if we say they are Milchama Mitzrayim, the Rambam's rule about Shevet Levi, the Rambam says Shevet Levi is pater even from Milchamet Mitzvah.
But the inference is that everyone else is not. Everyone has an equal chiyuv to come.
That's correct. Let me explain one thing. When we say for Milchamet Mitzvah, except for the Shana Rishona people, the Milchamet Mitzvah, everybody has to come. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean everybody has to come even if they don't need you. In other words, the Torah didn't mean in a Milchamet Mitzvah, everybody has to come. It means everybody has to be available to come if there's a military necessity. In other words, the Torah never said, you know, everybody has to show up for, you know, even if, you know, we don't need you. If anything, that might hurt their military efforts, the extra food. In fact, that's an issue with the Haredim as well. One of the dirty secrets, it's not such a secret, is that the push to draft Haredim and everybody into the army is not based on security concerns. There are no manpower shortages. There are enough people and enough volunteers and enough people who want to do this. It is based on cultural blending and the like. And in fact, people who are looking at it from a purely military standpoint actually don't want a lot of Haredim in the army. Number one, Haredim are bad influences. They may make other people religious. The army doesn't want that. Number two, they come in with a lot of demands. They got to re-kosher the kitchens, whatever. It's a lot of trouble. If there's not a manpower shortage, they don't want it. And whatever it is. And number three, the basic idea is from a military issue, there really is not a need for more manpower. So it's really much more of a political issue. But if it came, if it came to it, the truth of the matter is, if it came to it, the Rambam would exempt full-time people who are learning, but Haredim who are not in Kollel full-time would have to go to a Mochanas Mitzvah if there would be a need. Now, part of the issue is there may not be a military need. Yeah.
Question though, the Kohanim also didn't get territory in Israel, so we can assume that they didn't fight as well, correct?
That's correct. Well, every Kohen is a Shevet Levi.
Right.
Yeah.
But they did fight in Hanukkah against the Yemenim.
There is a precedent. I just want to point out, there is a precedent, but this was a case where they were the ones who galvanized the people, meaning to say most of the Jewish people in the Hanukkah story were passive and accepting of Greek Hellenism. So in a sense, like Pirkei Avos says, B'makom she'ein ish, where there's no person, you got to stand up. So that was an unusual situation. That was not an issue of conscripted Kohanim. That was an issue of Kohanim having to take the spiritual leadership to galvanize people in a war that many people did not want to fight. Okay, I'll save a little discussion about women for next time. Again, there is no declaration that women are pituros. However, you'll recall that Chazal say a consistent phrase that nashim are lav benos milchama ninu, that women are not people who are supposed to be engaged in combat. Which is interesting. What about non-combat, right? I just want to tell you that when Ben-Gurion, in the early years of the state, wanted to create a mandatory draft for women, even with an alternative of what's called Shevut Lumi, national service for women. National service, meaning you don't have to go to the army at all. What's national service? You go to a hospital, different things. So all of the Gedolim of that time, the Chazon Ish, Brisker Rav, the Visser Zalman, great, 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 great Gedolim. They all signed a big, big public proclamation that said that for a parent to let their daughter go into the either army or Sheirut Lumi, even in a non-combat role, is Yehareg Ve'al Yavar. They must allow themselves or their children to be killed before they would do such a thing, because this was considered to be such an endangerment of tznius. I'll talk about that a little bit, because from a pure halachic standpoint, it's a little hard to figure out. Okay, combat we understand. First of all, even in the United States, women throughout the world are based, in fact, in the United States, are really exempt from combat, although they could volunteer. But in a non-combat role, going to an office or Sheirut Lumi, listen, half of these women could do this anyway. They visit the hospital. What do they do? They do all sorts of chesed things. So what would have been the big problem had it been in the mascaret of Sheirut Lumi? Okay, I'll have to save it. I have to give another share now. But I just want you to be aware of the Torah's draft laws and compare Parshas Shoftim with Parshas Kisei.